This is the Digging Deeper podcast, where we engage in today's questions from a Christian perspective. Hello, my name is Josh Toth. This is Dr. Marty Baker. He's the senior pastor at Burke Community Church. And today we'll be talking about what is truth. Get sit in a coffee shop.
Oh, I just
for
had
free.
A conversation with a mother about her son who's studying to be a surgeon, all of his philosophical questions. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Okay.
That took up part of my morning.
Yeah. Interesting. Did they approach you with questions?
He did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he's having a crisis of faith.
Okay. Do you find you get more questions from people like who are coming from the faith or people who are like not convinced of the faith?
Well, it's probably 60-40, 60% are Christians.
Okay.
Because that's what's predominantly here.
Yeah.
But I had an investment broker in my office the other day, former Marine, very successful guy, not a Christian.
Yeah.
Had a whole bunch of questions. His wife couldn't answer who is a Christian. So she brought him in my office and said, he needs to talk to somebody about these questions. So we started going through all the questions. I answered all the questions. And then after a while, he's like, you've heard these before, haven't you? And I'm like,
Yeah.
He said, man, I thought these were just questions that were just my questions.
Yeah.
I go, well, no, they're the kind of questions non-Christians ask.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's answers to all those questions.
Is it like refreshing every time you can answer someone and be like, yeah, I've answered this before. And when they connect that these are questions everyone has and they don't feel
the questions I've had.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Anyway,
That's cool.
Yeah. So you're just constantly, talking to people.
Yeah. That's very cool.
Helping them along, like, helping the surgeon understand, a proper worldview as opposed to an improper worldview.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha.
And he's Christian, but he's got questions, but he doesn't know where to go find the answers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But anyway, so you're there to kind of help him understand how to find answers.
Yeah. Well, I think the toughest part is knowing you have questions and not knowing maybe what they are, if you just have the sense of uncertainty, I think that's where doubt is really like dangerous, because it just becomes this cloud of, there's no way of knowing. I don't know. I don't even know what I'm asking. So being able to talk with someone, even if you don't know what the questions are and,
that's not usually the kind of person that comes talks to me. It's usually a person, high functioning, educated kind of person with a ton of questions.
Yeah.
And they, sometimes they have them written out.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there are a few that don't really know what they're asking, but they're not the norm.
Okay.
Most people know exactly what their questions are that bother them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, it's like, okay, what are those questions? But they're questions I've asked over the years myself. So,
Do you ever feel caught off guard with a question?
No, not usually.
Yeah.
No, because as Solomon said, there's nothing new under the sun in Ecclesiastes 1. So most questions are like, well, that's been articulated before. I'm pretty much at this stage after 34 years of pastoring, kind of unshockable, because I've pretty much heard everything.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. Now some questions are thorny and they're hard to work through. But anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but I've read a lot, so I know like where people can go to find answers to some of those more complex questions.
Yeah. How often do you articulate, here's an answer versus saying, oh, there's a book on this or here's a...
Well, I usually tell them what the answer is and then I tell them where they can find the answer. And like with the surgeon, he went to a Christian school, Trinity.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which taught him a certain type of apologetic, but he didn't understand. So in a medical world, that method they taught him there doesn't fly in that medical world.
Interesting. Okay.
Because it's too Bible-centered.
Oh.
So since that method is refuted by the medical world, they don't accept the Bible as truth. So they, they just laugh him out of the room on that one.
Mm.
So he doesn't know how else to respond.
Yeah.
But when I tell him, oh, there's three other different apologetic methods you could use that are not biblical approaches, he's like, it's a eureka moment.
Yeah.
He's like, you're kidding me. So if you want to talk about truth, you got three other methods you can use to talk about truth that aren't validated by your holy book. Then you can build a bridge to your medical friends in ways that will more appeal to them.
Yeah. So he's asking, so what do you answer someone who has a faith and knows that the Bible is true, but is challenged by people who aren't going to have that common ground?
Yeah. Because that guy's approach is the Bible, because he went to Christian school.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he tries to use the Bible in a secular setting with other would-be surgeons who are not coming from that viewpoint, and the Bible's not a source of truth, he doesn't know how to refute them or how to guide them toward the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
So he's in a quandary. Mm-hmm. And since they keep hammering him from all sectors, then he's like, well, what do I do? You know, maybe my faith's not true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so anyway, so at that point, you try to reassure him that everything's okay. You just have to mature in your strategy, that you've been taught one method when there's four methods to defend the faith. And that's usually an aha moment to that person. What are the other methods, you know?
Yeah.
So he's taught what is called presuppositionalism, which teaches that the Bible is the source of all truth. And it is.
Okay, yeah.
And it is the standard of measurement, you know, for what is truth, and that's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that and can demonstrate why the Bible's an unusual book and why it is the book of truth regarding spiritual life and et cetera. But the world doesn't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
So in his medical culture, I wouldn't start there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's telling him, you need to move over to method one for the pursuit of truth, which is a classical approach to apologetics, which merely asks, can we know truth?
Mm-hmm.
What is truth? Is truth knowable?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to learn all the argumentation over there in method one, which can help him in his world, because he can talk about that method to his comrades all day long, because it's at their level. Because you're talking more philosophically, you're talking more about logic and reasoning and those types of things. Mm. That's a great place to start with them, asking them Socratic kind of questions.
Yeah.
And is it possible to know absolute truth? How should we define absolute truth? How do we measure what is truth? Mm. How do we know what is false, et cetera? He can ask them questions and eventually move them toward, there is a God who is the absolute measurement of what is truth.
Mm.
But he doesn't start there.
Yeah.
So classical apologetics is, you know, starting with the basic things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why is there something rather than nothing? Where did morality come from? Why are there morals?
Mm-hmm.
Why are morals very similar between all cultures? And so classical apologetics starts over there. And then the second method that he would need to learn is evidentialism. Evidentialism shows the evidences for Christian positions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so if Christ really did rise from the grave, then that changes everything.
Mm-hmm.
If that happened in time and space history.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the extra biblical references outside the Bible that prove he rose from the grave?
Mm-hmm.
What are the biblical references that he rose from the grave? Because I don't validate the truth of the resurrection just based on the biblical account.
Mm-hmm.
There's other extra biblical accounts that speak of the resurrection from, you know, Roman historians, et cetera. Jewish historians like Josephus, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So I build a case for the historicity of the resurrection based on extra biblical references, and I give that evidence to someone who wants to know, did Christ really rise from the grave? Well, here are the evidences.
Mm-hmm.
And then, is it logical to believe these evidences or not logical to believe these evidences? So that's the second method. Third method is presuppositionalism, his method, the Bible.
Okay.
And then fideism is the fourth method, which is the faith statement, that your faith that saved you has radically changed you, and your changed life that now lives for God is a great evidence that some divine power has done this for you. Which, you know, my best friend that spent half his life in San Quentin Penitentiary as a felon, got saved in there, got out. I got him a job working with me when I was first married 42 years ago and discipled him for a year before I went to seminary. Alan was a new man in Christ, you know, but he was covered in tattoos, knife wounds, you know, long stringy hair, scary looking dude, but he loved Christ.
Yeah.
But the faith argument for him was totally powerful, because all of his gangster buddies are like, dude, what happened to you?
Yeah.
Well, he met Christ in prison, you know, and now he's a new man. Mm. So his life change is an argument for there must be a God who moved Alan out of, trying to murder people, shoot people, rob people, deal with drugs, take drugs. I mean, he left all that behind to follow Christ.
Yeah.
So that's that argument.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so I told that surgeon to be, I was talking with his mother, but I talked to him earlier by email, but just telling him there's four methods.
Mm-hmm.
You've only been using one method. Mm-hmm. So your friends are attacking method three as a source of truth.
Mm.
And then they refute your book. Well, then what do you do? Well, there's, so you just need to learn how to think differently.
Yeah.
And that takes a while. So, you know, I told them I've read thousands of pages on said subject so I can help you not waste your time as a medical student.
Yeah.
Read this. Don't waste your time with that. And, you know, I can coach you along to help you get these other methods in your head and other strategies that you can use.
Yeah.
And so that's what they get excited about.
Mm.
And that's what's fun is showing people those things. Because they're like, well, I never knew that.
Mm.
So anyway.
Yeah. And I bet, I mean, as a believer who like grew up in the church, I'm sure it's almost freeing in some way to realize like, hey, you don't need to prove it to them via the Bible first, because that's not a common ground to say like, you know, use other evidences because it's true and it's evidenced outside of just scripture. And so if someone's right. like, well, I grew up with this and everyone around me believed it. And so like, hey guys, this is what I believe. And they're like, no, that's dumb. You know, and that can be destabilizing if you're like, this is all I'm standing, you know, right. the only evidence I hold to.
Yeah.
Or argument. I mean,
the Bible claims to be the book of truth. And so, how do I know it's God's book?
Mm.
You know, well, in a medical community, you can't start there. You need to start with the fact of, is there a God? Mm. Is there a divine being? Mm. That's method one.
Yeah.
So how do I know there's a divine being?
Yeah.
Well, all of the arguments that are, you can put together philosophically to guide a person toward divine belief. And there's many of them. You present those in method one. Method three is looking at the scriptures is, well, then how do I validate the Bible? If there is a God, method one, and I can give you great reasons for why that's the most logical position, then method three is, well, if there's a God, then he could have spoken.
Yeah.
Well, if he spoke, how would I know which holy book is his?
Mm.
Well, then that's a whole nother thing. So, so of all of the so-called holy books in the world, what would you expect them to contain if they were from God himself, who's outside of time and space? And so when you look at the Bible as the source of truth, as opposed to that which is not true, it is the only book of all holy books that prophesies with specificity.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking extreme specificity. So hundreds of years before the fact, you know, the rise and fall of kings, rise and falls of nations, naming the, you know, Cyrus was named as king of Persia to deliver Israel from Babylonian bondage, you know, like 120 years, I think, before he ever even showed up.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't even pick stocks from day to day that are going to do well.
Yeah.
So God does a lot of in-your-face prophecies to statistically show you it's impossible for these to be been known by man, because Cyrus, king of Persia, Persia didn't even exist as a major power in 539 BC when he freed the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
So how could it even, you couldn't even like geopolitically put it together.
Yeah, there's no guess.
No. So so if you look at the scriptures validate themselves based on the prophetic value of the scriptures.
Mm.
They show you that they are truth because it matches reality.
Yeah.
What is truth? Truth is that which matches reality. The Bible claims to be the holy book of all holy books. Well, how do I know that? Well, it doesn't just have good moral teaching in it, which it does, but it does things that you would expect that only God could allow it to do.
Mm.
Regarding time and space. So how can it predict, like in the book of Daniel, chapter 2 and chapter 7, how can it predict the rise and fall of major world empires hundreds of years before they ever hit the planet and they fell in exactly the order as prophesied with great specificity by Daniel? There's no way a man could know these things. Mm-hmm. God had to have told him.
Yeah.
So it's just things like that. The prophecy of how the fortress Tyre would fall, fell exactly like God said it was. There was Tyre on the coast, and there was Tyre out on the island, and there was a kingdom that nobody could defeat, the Tyrene fortress. But when it fell, it was prophesied that a causeway would be built, and it would be attacked and everything. This is exactly what Alexander the Great did. Mm. I mean, to the letter.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, there's no way these could be known hundreds of years before the fact, because the Grecian Empire wasn't a world power.
Yeah.
I mean, and so that's where you start looking at those things going, there's only, God had to have spoken to Daniel.
Yeah.
You know, to Isaiah, and gave him the details, because they're so exact. Mm. Only God, who is omniscient by definition of who he is, could have told these things.
Yeah. I mean, it's like predicting 21st century politics of America in the 1600s. It's like, I don't know who could have done that 5 years ago. But
So in classical apologetics, you have to first decide, is there truth worth even talking about?
Mm.
So what is truth? Truth corresponds to reality. It matches reality. So the Bible claims to be the essence of all spiritual religious truth. How do I validate it?
Mm.
Well, I test it.
Yeah.
You know, does it contradict reality? No, it verifies reality.
Mm.
You know, so when I look at like the Book of Mormon, the Book of Mormon claims to be a holy book, but the Book of Mormon doesn't match the flora and fauna of upstate New York, where it claims to come from. It details huge Indians groups that fought against each other in massive battles. They have found no arrowheads. They found no spearheads. They have found no ostraca, no pottery. They found nothing from these giant Indian tribes that supposedly lived in the Camorra area of New York. You can't validate the story. It doesn't match the geography. Doesn't match the flora and fauna. They find no archaeological evidence at all.
Yeah.
But when I take people to Israel on tours, and we go to Solomon's Fortress of Megiddo in the Valley of Armageddon, go to any one of these, and there's the history.
Mm.
It matches what the Bible says happened.
Mm.
The flora, the fauna, the geography, et cetera. It's a one-to-one correlation. It's telling you the truth.
Yeah.
It corresponds to the facts.
Mm.
That's a correspondence view of truth, is I can verify it by testing it.
Yeah.
So the good doctor to be, you know, can use the Bible as the power of the Word of God. It has great power. God says it won't return void if used, no doubt.
Yeah.
And there's great reason to believe it's God's book, because no other book on the planet has the prophetic insight that it does.
Yeah.
None. And I've read a ton of holy books, and they don't do this.
Yeah.
So when you're looking at truth, you know, that's how you can verify whether the Bible's, should I believe it?
Mm.
Well, mathematically, it's impossible for the prophets to foretell these things.
Mm.
I mean, how did Daniel know, when he's carried away in captivity in 605 BC, how did he know the Babylonian Empire, the major power of the earth, is going to be overthrown, by the Medes and the Persians? How did he know that?
Yeah.
You know, and then how did he know that the Persian Empire would be overthrown by the Alexandrian Empire? How did he know that?
Mm-hmm.
And then, because Alexander's empire wasn't a great empire. And then how did he prophesy the rise of the Roman Empire after the demise of the Grecian Empire?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he even prophesies how Alexander's empire broke up among his three generals after his death. How did he know that?
Mm-hmm.
God had to tell him.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, and then how did he foretell the rise of the Roman Empire, which wasn't even on the planet?
Mm-hmm.
How it would rise, how it would fall, how it would behave. All those things are so specific, only God could know them, who knows time.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do I validate the truth of the scriptures? Well, I look at the prophetic value and I test it to see, is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Did that happen then?
Mm-hmm.
And then I can rest assured that there's no book like this book.
Yeah.
So the doctor could, he's not, I don't think he's skilled in defending the veracity of the scriptures yet. He needs to bone up on that. But he could rest on view three, method three. But when you're pursuing truth, methods one and two aren't bad either.
Yeah. Now with truth, I want to talk about relativism, because that's a topic that obviously comes up with truth, and you know, and relativity is a real thing, right? Like, there's, you know, relative to the sun, we're moving really fast. Relative to cars on the parkway, we're sitting completely still. So what does relativity do to the truth? And because I think a lot of people respond to truth, and there's less, I've seen people, less of a refutation and more of an acceptance that that's true, and so is this. It's not so much, well, let me you know, challenge that. It's kind of, it's more of a, okay, well, that's fine if you think, if that's true for, you know.
Right, I got it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. Mm-hmm. So relativism is an extremely tenuous viewpoint to hold, because it's self-defeating philosophically. So it's claiming no absolutes exist, so therefore everything must absolutely be true. Mm-hmm. If everything's absolutely true, then nothing's false.
Can we break that down a little more? I'd love to hear that. So you said relativism, everything's absolutely true if relativism is true.
It's true to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's true to you. It must be true.
Yeah.
But if everything is true to the people from their perspective, then nothing by definition is false.
Okay.
But we live in a world where we know things are false.
Mm-hmm.
So we all have what I would call a built-in baloney meter, that when you hear stuff, your register goes off and you're like, there is no way that is true, because you know that some things are false.
Mm.
So you couldn't even know anything is if everything is true, how could you know it's true unless you knew the opposite of it?
Mm.
You would have to know the opposite of it for even to make the claim that it's true. That's another problem with it. But it's self-defeating in the sense that relativism assumes that truth is relative to people or to groups.
Mm.
Well, that's an absolute statement.
Yeah.
So relativism defies absolutes, moral absolutes.
Yeah.
But it assumes moral absolutism to create its position.
Mm.
That makes it self-defeating.
Yeah.
That makes it not worth following.
Yeah.
Because it's grabbing from the tree that I pull my fruit off of, absolutism, that I believe.
Yeah.
And it's moving it over to their tree. And they're using it, but they're not claiming it.
Mm.
So relativism claims that truth is relative to people or to a person.
Mm.
Absolutely, that's the position.
Yeah, but that only works if that's the only way it works, is that.
But that's self-defeating. I mean, that philosophically is self-defeating.
Yeah.
You just assumed my position and proved to me that absolutes do exist, absolutely.
Mm.
So therefore, that's why I'm not a relativist, you know? Truth is true no matter how I feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's two ways to look at truth. There's the correspondence view of truth we already talked about. Then there's the coherence view of truth. Mm-hmm. So the correspondence view of truth is, I know this microphone is here and it's not a projection of my mind because, I can test it.
Mm-hmm.
I can touch it, I could hit it. Mm-hmm. The sound guy would probably be upset if I did. I could taste it. I could bite it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can do a lot of things to test to see if I could set it on fire. I can test it and verify to you, hey, this thing's really here.
Yeah.
Because it corresponds to reality.
Mm-hmm.
That's a Christian view of truth.
Mm-hmm.
Truth has to correspond to the facts.
Mm-hmm.
Correspondence view of truth is our view. Coherent view of truth is a relativistic view of truth.
Okay.
So what a coherence view believes is, if I emotionally feel this is true for me, it must by definition be true. And if I get enough of people together that hold my viewpoint, even though it goes against the cultural viewpoint, what they say is true, since we collectively cohere and believe this is true for us in our little group, it is ipso facto true.
Yeah.
So the problem with that is, if everybody coheres and has their own little groups of truth, and they're all true, even though they diametrically oppose each other, you end up with chaos because nothing's true.
Yeah. Now, I'd love to play devil's advocate a bit for that. What do you, like, I feel that we see the correspondence is the second one, right?
Correspondence is the first one.
Second one.
Coherence is the second one.
Okay.
And yeah.
So I feel like we see, you know, in the arts, for example, we see coherence truth where it's like, there's not really a specifically, this is objectively a good piece of art, this is objectively a bad piece of art. And that's its whole conversation. But what do you do? Like, how does that play into it in the, you know, like the arts or in music? Like, we can say, you know, I love this band or I love this song. Like, how does, because our emotions do inform what we value in certain lights, right?
But that's talking about beauty.
Okay.
That's not talking about mathematics. I mean, okay. You know, a geometric theorem is a theorem.
Mm-hmm.
And you might not like it. I didn't like memorizing them all in school, but they are true.
Yeah.
So if you want to find, you know, a measurement and a parallelogram,
yeah,
there are certain equations you have to do that are absolutely true that never change. To sit in class and go, well, hey, you know, I kind of emotionally having a moment here where I don't feel that this theorem is really being fair to how I feel about it. And so I'm taking a different viewpoint.
Yeah.
But you're not going to pass that class.
Yeah.
Because your emotion, how you feel about it, doesn't alter the truth of the theorem.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm looking at a piece of, you know, of a Rembrandt, you know, if I'm listening to a you know, an etude by Chopin, you know, if I'm listening to, you know, a heavy metal song with Van Halen, one of my groups, you know, if I'm listening to those, I might like those and I might think they're great and you might not think they're great. You might like other things. That's more a personal, that's an opinion of how you appreciate something that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But it still doesn't change the fact that, well, Chopin wrote this. Yes, mm-hmm. those are the notes that he wrote. That's exactly how he put those runs in at that given point.
Mm-hmm.
It still corresponds to reality that piece actually exists and that painting was made in such a way, painted with certain kind of paints, certain kinds of oils. The painting doesn't change.
Yeah.
So you might have a different emotional appealing of it, but it doesn't change the truth that the painting's there or that the rock group is there.
Yeah. Are you saying that, like, between there's truth and there's objectivity, right? And then there's beauty. So how, like, help me figure out where those things belong in categorizing those things, right? How do we know when to apply?
Okay, let's just break it down to, you like ice cream?
Of course.
Okay, so who doesn't like ice cream? Yeah. So I was introduced to Bluebell ice cream going to Dallas Seminary back in the early 80s. It's the food of the gods. It's unbelievable. So, but they don't make my favorite anymore, Tin Roof Sundae. I don't know what happened to that.
What was on that? What was in that one?
It was vanilla laced with chocolate and peanuts.
Can't go wrong.
It would totally change your life.
Yeah, dang.
But so they don't make that anymore. So Bluebell ice cream now is sold here on the East Coast.
Okay.
Started a couple years ago. It's totally cool. So if you and I were to go to the grocery store and look at a freezer full of Bluebell ice cream, you know, you're going to see all the cool flavors.
Yeah.
And you're going to have your favorites and I'm going to have mine. Mm. That's just a personal choice based on taste, et cetera. But one of us would be foolish if we were to say, hey man, I really don't think that the ice cream is really in the freezer section.
Mm.
That's just how I feel about it.
Yeah.
That's a whole different discussion than saying, I like pistachio or I like, you know, birthday cake ice cream. That's a personal preference of something that actually exists.
Yeah.
When you're looking at truth, is it there?
Yeah.
Do you see a tub of ice cream there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. If you're looking at me going, no, those that looks like Oreo cookies to me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I got numbers you need to call because we're not, in my perspective, correspondence view of truth, there's tubs of ice cream sitting there, not tubs of ice cream and a couple of, you know, packages of Oreo cookies sitting there, not unless somebody threw them in there. But if what you're seeing doesn't match reality, that's a whole nother discussion.
Yeah.
So personal preference on what you like is one thing, but it doesn't change the truth of what's there.
Yeah. Now, I think it's interesting because I think the relativism right now is so much, I want to have personal preference on the truth. Like I want the truth to be the thing that's in the, you know, in the freezer and I choose which one. And so like how do we make sense of that? And how do we make truth not be different flavor? Like how do we articulate truth in a way that doesn't seem like it's flavors of Bluebell ice cream? It's like, no, this is ice cream or it's not, right? Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in philosophy, when Aristotle studied logic, and he didn't create logical analysis, he discovered it. Mm-hmm. So in all logical principles, the first rule of logic, the law of non-contradiction, is where you start. And it's the bedrock of all thinking. So what it states is two things cannot be true at the same time and in the same sense. So we can't stand outside the freezer and I say there's Bluebell ice cream inside that freezer, and you're looking at the same freezer going, I don't see Bluebell ice cream in there. In fact, I don't see any ice cream at all. Somebody's telling the truth. Somebody is not telling the truth. One view corresponds to reality, one does not. So you can't have all those claims being made at the same time and they're diametrically opposed. So you can't open the door and go, oh, all those are options for truth. When it comes to morality, sex, gender, pick the topic. You know, they're all free and loose and they can be whatever they want to be, because that's not how the world works. There is claims made that there is this and then there's this, and they're diametrically opposed. How do I know which is the right one? There has to be one that is absolutely true. You could take it and change the analogy to gravity and say, you know, if I open up the freezer and it's like there's a box in there that says, you know, gravity, and there's a one that says, well, there is no gravity. Well, one guy believes one guy believes the other, but if you go test them, which is the correspondence view of truth, by standing on a three-story building, and you who don't believe in gravity.
Yeah, that wouldn't end well.
Yeah, I'll be at your funeral. You know, I mean, you can emotionally believe that all you want, but based on law of non-contradiction, when you're looking at truth claims, there's going to be, they cannot be diametrically opposed and be true at the same time. It's the world doesn't function that way.
Yeah.
You know, like you're sitting in a chair. If you were to tell me I'm not sitting in a chair, defies reality.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but if you say, you know, well, that's just how I feel. That's what I want to be truth for me. Okay. You can believe that, but I'm going to challenge you that I really think there's a chair there.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not a smorgasbord when it comes to truth, because truth is always absolute. And so, you know, it's telling people, you know, to think through what they're claiming, you know, so like the debate with transgenderism or pick any topic, you know, to say there's, you know, one side says there's two genders and there's two sexes. The other side is, oh no, we bifurcate, you know, gender from sexuality. And so we can have 100 genders. And so these are two totally different things, two truth claims that are made at the same time based on Aristotelian logic. They can't both be true at the same time. So you have to test them. And that's where you arrive at which one matches reality, which one doesn't match reality.
Could you apply that sense of truth and facts to beauty, and what, like, how do we not apply it to beauty also, maybe, is the question I'm asking. Like, how can we not say, for example, if I was like, classic rock stinks, and you were like, classic rock is the best, like, can we apply that method, or is it beyond that method?
So, so like in classic rock, if you think it, somebody's think it stinks and somebody likes it, it doesn't change the fact that there is classic rock. So somebody might say, you know, there are two genders. Some might say there's 100 genders, but it doesn't change the fact that there's two genders. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Why? Because it matches reality. It matches binary function, how we're created. We're made in a binary fashion to reproduce, as the scriptures say. And, you know, it says in Psalm 139 that God has wonderfully made us individually. So he made a mistake. So, you know, once you start messing with your construction and you don't think that it's the right construction, you're challenging the very God who designed you and telling him, I don't like how you designed me, and I think you made me in an incorrect format. When you should be embracing the greatness of how he made you and enjoying it. But once you embrace a viewpoint that's not attached to reality, then anything's possible. And then that doesn't correspond to the facts. So you create your own facts, build your own little group around you that will support you in your facts. And then you can rationalize your activities and feel great about yourself. But that's what people do in all kinds of areas, in all kinds of grouping, with political, you know, you know, people who are liberal in politics, people who are conservative. I mean, they build themselves in little groups.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so it's done across the board in all kinds of ways.
Yeah. We love our tribalism.
Huh?
I said, we love our tribalism. Our brilliant
groups. This is true, but you know, is one better than the other? You know, is the question. So, a person can be into, you know, I prefer this or prefer that, but it doesn't change what I am by reality. You know, so truth has to match the facts. You know, that there's a lot of things in our world that don't match the facts, and we're being told to believe them when we know they don't match the facts. You know, and that's the tragic thing of our culture. Is they're wanting us to believe things that are lies when we know those positions, be what they may, defy truth as we know it, because God built into the warp and woof of our being understanding that truth is that which relates to what is. And I can test it.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to hear more, give us a follow and join us next week as we continue to talk with Dr. Marty Baker about why apologetics is important.